If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, AMI Quebec, Forward House, or Prevention Suicide.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 19 days into the month of August. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with Stephen Lapierre from Réplique on the recent demonstration by Jonathan Marchand in front of the Assemblée Nationale de Québec. Then, an interview with Amy Lowe on her recent book, Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete. All that and more, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are tuned into The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at cqt.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Today's show, an interview with Stephen Lapierre from Réplique on the recent demonstration by Jonathan Marchand in front of the Assemblée Nationale de Québec, protesting the housing of young people with disabilities in CHSLDs. This demonstration lasted from August 12th to August 17th. That's up now. So hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show. Could you introduce yourself and your involvement with Réplique?
Well, thank you for having me, Zoe. My name is Stephen Lapierre. I am the general manager of the Réplique.
On August 14th, you released a statement in support of Jonathan Marchand. Jonathan is a disability rights activist who protested in front of the Assemblée Nationale de Québec about institutionalization in CHSLDs. Could you describe the conditions that led to this manifestation?
Jonathan has been living in a CHSLD for about 10 years now, and the last 30 months or so, he built an association which is called a Co-op Assist. And the main idea behind that is to get home care assistance 4 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days, instead of being held prisoner in a CHSLD. Why we say he's being held as a prisoner? Because Jonathan is a 43-year-old man. He is amongst elderly people that have cognition problems, that are very sick. And it's not, they call it un milieu de vie, but it's everything but that. And besides, when he's not free to go wherever he wants, when he wants, he needs to ask permission to go out. Sometimes it's granted, sometimes it's not. As unbelievable as that sounds, those are the cold hard facts. So all this to create this project, which is really an autonomous life project, the autonome project, where you build, you take example on the existing cooperatives of habitations. There are many amongst Montreal, except the difference between this co-op and what Jonathan is dreaming about is it would be a cooperative where it would be handicapped person. So it would be financed by government money, of course, but it would be managed by the handicapped persons for the handicapped persons, where they would have their own budgets, they would hire their own home caregivers, and they would be in the full possession of their lives. So that was the main idea leading to this project, because after 30 months, many representations to government officials and staffers and what have you, everybody says it's very sensitive to the issue, but nothing moves. A few months ago, Jonathan decided that it was enough and it was time for action. It was a call to action, really. And he said, okay, if they don't understand what I'm trying to tell them, then I'm going to show them. So he decided to cage himself in front of the Assemblée Nationale. It was actually like a tent, but instead of material on the sides, it was really a fence to show it's a cage, with everything he needs, because Jonathan needs assistance 24 hours a day. So he needed a lot of assistance, a lot of care. So everybody was there with him. He had his caregivers with him. So it was the idea just to say, hey, if the government doesn't understand, I'm going to show them. And one of his main requests was that Prime Minister Legault goes to meet him. And that never happened. So he sent Marilyn Picard, which is another elected official. They came up with some kind of agreements. I don't have all the details yet because this happened like only hours ago. Mm-hmm. But enough for Jonathan to leave camp and return back to where he lives. Hopefully this is a promise that handicapped persons will have more choices when it comes to their life, when it comes to living where they want within their family, within their support system, because that's the whole idea, you know, to have, let's stop to institutionalize people and give them the choice to live where they want to live, where they can. In fact, also, because Jonathan, with all the situation he has, this guy is a mastermind. This guy can do most anything when it comes to computer engineering and all that. So he needs a chance to be a part of the society and contribute.
So one of the goals of the protest was to secure a meeting with Premier Legault. What are some other goals of the manifestation?
Correct. That's right. And like I said, that meeting with Mr. Legault didn't happen. Mrs. Marguerite Blais went there on the first day. But at the end of the day, during the weekend and today, my understanding is that most of the negotiations happened with Marilyn Picard. Like I said, they offered a promise and some other things, which I don't have all the details. But we all hope, all the community of handicapped persons, we all hope that it's really significant for the future of all handicapped persons, because it was a real gutsy move from Jonathan to do what he did. Imagine living out 5 days in a caged tent on the side of the street in front of the National Assembly, where there's a lot of traffic, a lot of people go there, and with his specific condition, it was a really, really gutsy move to do that. And I find it I would say shameful that the Prime Minister didn't go and meet him while he meets with so many other people. My own personal reading of that is that if Prime Minister Legault had gone to see Jonathan, it would be some kind of admission that the system is dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. But at this point, know that the system is dysfunctional. And it's not the CACs or Prime Minister Legault's fault. He wasn't there for the last 50 years. So for me, when Jonathan explained me his thought on this, I agreed with him. It was a chance to say, okay, this system doesn't work. It's not your fault, Jonathan. It's not our fault. We were not there. Let's a new page, a white page, and build something that's convenient for everyone to give people a choice when it comes to their life. Because we institutionalize them, we medicalize them, and we always see them as unable to do stuff We have to change that vision. And that's what we were hoping for. And we thought Mr. Legault would have that hope to consider all these things. But that never happened. That meeting with Mr. Legault did not happen. So we'll see what lies ahead. But should we say that we are confident? We are certainly hopeful. And we are in full support of Jonathan, of course.
You mentioned that the problems in regards to young people with disabilities living in, say, HSLDs has been prevalent long since Premier Legault. And you mentioned it being a procedure for around 15 years. What's the history and the background behind young people being institutionalized in CHSLDs?
At the beginning, the main idea behind CHSLDs was to bring the people there that were at the end of their lives or suffered from dementia. At the beginning, at the very beginning, that was the point. And then along the way, and it came to a point where people that needed heavy cares, 24 hours, 7 a day, they could not stay in hospitals, of course. Some of them could not live at home because their problems were too heavy to manage on a daily basis. So slowly but surely, people were integrated into CHSLDs, and it went on and on and on, and we are here today. Today, there's about 3% of the handicapped persons that are under 65. Is it 3% or 2% in this area that live in CHSLDs, which are not an accurate place for them to be in, because you're in an environment, a living environment, that's not compatible to who you are at that age. It's not a very place to be stimulated for a living or for working and whatever. And if you add to that you're not really free to go in or go out whenever you want, it's an additional pressure. Speak your mind, and you're suddenly you realize that you're really in a cage and dependent of every person around you. It's a heavy burden to bear. And if you're at the wrong place, it makes it even harder.
So you mentioned, as well as Jonathan, that the setup that they had in front of the Assemblée Nationale was described as a cage. Yes. What are the conditions like in long-term care homes?
That's exactly it. That's a cage. You get up at the same time. You get fed at the same time. You get your medication at the same time. You have a brunch at the same time. You have dinner at the same time. It's a very routine place to live in. It's always the same. You have certainly, I don't think we can say that the people there don't receive good cares, but it's very repetitive. And like I said, the most important thing is that you have no control over what your day is going to be like, because it's either always going to be the same. And and if you want to go out, you have to ask permission, and it's not always granted. Plus all the other problems that come with being handicapped. We're talking about adapted transport and all the places where you want to go. You have to inquire if they're accessible or not. So it's a series of problems. That can a part of these problems can be settled if you're home. At least you're free to go where you want, when you want. You can make your proper arrangements without even thinking, okay, will I be able to go out if I make all these arrangements for my outing? It's very tough. It's very lonely. It's very depressing, actually.
And how does the prevalence of young disabled people in seniors' home impact their lives?
When you're not in a environment that is lively, that is very stimulating to one person, it gets to you with time. You need to be stimulated in your life. I mean, we interact, we're here talking, we interact with each other. There's something going on, and it's the same every day of our life where we talk to different people, we interact. It brings color, it brings life, it makes you think, it makes you reflect on issues and sometimes change your minds and stuff like that. And also, what do you have as a stimulus to think, to get your daily drive on issues? You have the TV, and that's about it. And Jonathan is lucky in a sense that he has a girlfriend, he has friends. But some of them are not so lucky. Some of them have very few family, very few friends, and therefore very few activities. So can you just picture yourself at 43 amongst, and what kind of life is that? it's not a life. It's not interesting to live in those conditions. And Jonathan has a long life expectancy. So for him, living like that the next 20, 30 years doesn't make sense. And that was one of the main premises of his demonstration.
In your letter of support, you mentioned that there was misinformation being spread by the government about Mr. Marchand and the level of care he was being provided. Could you elaborate on this?
Well, actually, there is a lot of misinformation, and the government is responsible for a lot of misinterpretations. We've been asking numbers as far as how much does it cost to have people, if you want to make an average, how much does it cost to have to take care of somebody like Jonathan daily in a CHSLD on a yearly basis, and how much does it cost to have the same kind of home caregivers in a home in the private place for Jonathan. And it's hard to get to have access to these numbers. Government doesn't give numbers very easily. And so that's one of the causes of the misinterpretation. Some people say it costs $90,000 to the state to have Jonathan in the CHSLD. Some say it's $250,000. Some say it's $125,000, $30,000. The numbers is not official. But we know that if you make the average, I mean, we can all take our calculators and figure it out. We can make an average of the salaries of home caregivers, and we can make an average for all the people that receive home care services at home. And we are sure that we can say that living at home with the same kind of services Jonathan has in the CHSLDs will cost less to the society. We know that for sure. There's no way it can be topper than that. If you make an average, you have to take into consideration that a lot of the people that receive home care services, they do not require services 24/7. They require 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours daily. And that would be more the average of the services that are given at home to people. So the average, if you take all the people that are institutionalized right now and take them in a co-op the way Jonathan proposes, it's guaranteed that first they will be healthier, they will be happier, and it will cost less to the society.
So as of recording today, August 17th, the government and Jonathan came to an agreement and Jonathan took down the site. The CS has agreed to develop plans to begin the process of moving Marchand from the CHSLD. How do you feel this recent development will impact people in similar situations?
Well, like I said earlier, we certainly are hopeful that this committee that was built around Jonathan's actions has a strong mandate. And by a strong mandate, I mean a mandate to make things happen, because you have two types of committees. You have the committees that have the mandate to make things happen, and you have a committee that has the mandate to study things. And committees that study things, they come up with recommendations, but never a lot of things happen between after that. So we hope this committee has a strong mandate to make things happen, to take Jonathan's project and build from there and make it better, make it stronger, and make it more accessible, or make it accessible to more people possible. That would be the impact that Jonathan's actions has led to. To us, it's very important that it leads to that, because a committee that only comes up with recommendations, that will lead us to December 31st. They have to make recommendations. And then after that, we start the electoral pre-campaign in 2021. The election in 2022. So nothing much will, I don't expect nothing much to move if it does not happen fast. So we hope, we are hopeful that this committee has the right mandate and has the right people to get things in motions fast. That's our hope, and that's how it will impact people. Because if we don't get that, I mean, what will be the final outcome of that? Will life be a bit better in CHSLDs? Well, maybe it will be, but you will still be stuck there.
So what does the prevalence of young people with disabilities in these types of homes speak for the greater trend of institutionalized people with disabilities versus creating a community-based care model?
Well, you know, there was a time not that long ago where all elderly people were taken care of by their own families, and it made them live longer and wealthier and happier. And I hope those kind of co-ops, if they ever come to life, and when they will come to life, because I'm rather on the optimist side of things, when they come to life, it will change the whole thing. It will change the lives of people that live in co-ops, because first of all, you'll be able to have, just within the co-op, you'll be able to have a social life if you want it with your neighbors, which have, some of them have might have the same particularities than you have. So it favors more exchanges between residents. So that would be one thing. But also, and there again, and I know I'm repeating myself, but you have to be, you have to have stimulus in life. You have to be, able to talk to people that will add color and opinion and actions to your life. And when you don't have that, your life gets very boring. So you want to get away from that as much as possible. The more drive, the more stimulus you have in your life, the more you want to do. It's normal. So you have to have exchange, interaction with people. That's the motor of everything. And when you don't have that, when you're not stimulated, you just kind of, well, let yourself go and go with the flow, and there's nothing to be done. So that's why these co-op models have proven to be economically viable. So now it's time to push it up one note and bring people like Jonathan within a co-op, let them administrate themselves, let them take care of themselves, because nobody knows what's better for them than themselves.
How can we adapt our society in order to move towards a community-based care model versus institutionalization?
That's a huge question, but the main factor, I think, Zoe, is that we have to change our perceptions of handicapped persons. People think that handicapped persons, they don't work, they don't have a social life, they don't travel, they go to bed early. That's a preconceived idea that a lot of people have. I mean, we have to change our way. And like I said earlier, the question I always ask to everybody that asks me, what is a handicap? Is it the wheelchair, or is it the step that prevents you from going into a business with your wheelchair? So my question, is it the wheelchair that's the handicap, or is it the stair that prevents you from participating into society? So it's an image. Our judgments are pre-decided in their minds, because we're not familiar with that. Taking care, taking charge of your own life, where you want to live, who's going to give you your personal cares, when to go out, can I go see a concert, can I go see a movie? So we have to change our way of thinking when we see a handicapped person. Mm-hmm. And if that's a step that prevents that, then let's just destroy this step and build a ramp and make it happen. Need more strong figures. And I think that the action that Jonathan led the last few days, the last week or so, certainly will contribute to that, because the reactions are very positive. We are always surprised to see that a lot of people don't know about what life in a CHSLD is. What does it mean to require 24/7 help with a home caregiver? So there's a good side to it that it awakes more people to their reality. And hopefully this will be the first steps that will reconcile, you know, handicapped persons with non-handicapped persons. One of my hopes.
And what needs to be done on a political and general structure of society level?
One thing that we're very, very tired of, and there I'll speak about the federal government, the provincial government, and the municipal government, when we take some revendications to them, they say, oh, you know what, we are very sensitive to what you're saying. Well, I say, no more, don't be sensitive. It's not time to be sensitive anymore. We've heard it so many times, it's become a joke. So, you know, we don't want you to be sensitive. We want you to understand what the hell we're talking about. we want you to figure out what is the problem and what you can do to help. Because one thing that we like to do at Traplique, and I know other organizations are the same, when we come up with a problem, we try to also launch a solution. There's a problem. Here's what we think we can start with to try to fix it. It's always the way we do things. It's hard to be told that we are very sensitive to your problem, but we will not do anything right. So that's part of what I was saying earlier. We have to change our scope on handicapped persons. Those reserved parking spaces, they exist for one reason. Adapted transport exists for one reason, because it's a need, because our subway system is still not halfway close to being accessible. So we have to take those into balance, because when you live in a city, you live in a society, and in a society, you have different kinds of people. And amongst those different kinds of people, you have handicapped persons. And handicapped persons in Montreal are about 20% of the population that have one type of handicap or another. So you have to take that into account, as well as other people. But when it comes to handicapped persons, you lose your parking space. What do you think about that? And then city officials will tell you that they are very sensitive to your situation, sir, but hey, bikes are more important. So it becomes a balance. I mean, if you look back at the daily press conferences during the pandemic from March to up to recently, how many times has the persons giving out the press conference, whether it's Premier Legault, Mrs. McCann at the time, Mr. Arruda, or now Mr. Dubé, or all the others that came in, how many times have they talked about handicapped persons? Mm-hmm. Not many, right? Not many. When you add all this reserved parking spaces and Débarcadère and those issues where handicapped persons are almost always systematically taken out of society issues, you feel like a second or third class citizen. And we have to change that. And we advocate for that, because sometimes the problems comes from the political side of things, because it costs money to adapt places for handicapped persons. It's true. It costs money. It's absolutely true. But I'll reply to you that, hey, to build that parking space, it costs a lot. To have that elevator, it costs a lot. I mean, so if you want to go into that game, I mean, I can play that game all day long if you want. But at the end of the day, it should be equal chances for everyone.
And how is your organization supporting Jonathan?
When he talked to us about it, we were certainly supportive. He was so well organized that we tagged along. I mean, we followed along. I was there on the day he made camp. Other of our members were there for almost every day. Michel in Quebec, one of our members that lives in Quebec, was there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. On Sunday, we sponsored lunches for everyone that was there, because one of the concerns we had was that as time went by, there was an issue with having caregivers to Jonathan for the night shift from 10 at night to 8 in the morning. So we before the situation came to its issue that we now know of, we offered the Jonathan's team to sponsor, to pay for the caregivers for at least a few days. And we were certainly ready to make a call to other organizations come with us in that pool of to raise money for Jonathan's care if the camp was to stay a bit longer, but it didn't come to happen. We certainly used our social medias to raise awareness about Jonathan's situation and his actions and his situation in Quebec as they happen. And we certainly, I mean, we were supportive like the other organizations were. It was, this action is one of the very few that longtime activists can remember, that a lot of organizations came together in support of one cause. We were all speaking Jonathan's language, because It was a hell of a revendication to make. It was a heck of an action to take in front of the Assemblée Nationale. It took a lot. I mean, you had to have a lot of guts to do it, and he made it and came out with something. I guess the end result will be known early next year in early January when the recommendations are made. But what he did commands and earns our full respect.
And where can listeners find information about your organization?
They can certainly go to our website, which is réplique.org, or our Facebook page, réplique, which is the acronym for Regroupement des Activistes pour l'Inclusion au Québec. We're on Facebook and Twitter. And our coordinates are there. If people want to know more, I mean, they can contact us through our messenger or our website or our phone. We're there to answer questions anytime.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Welcome back to The Avalanche at CQT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an interview with Stephen Laperriere from Réplique on Jonathan Marchand's recent demonstration. Up now is an interview with Amy Lowe on her recent book, Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete, on Frog Hollow Press. So, hi Amy, welcome back to The Avalanche.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, could you tell our listeners a bit about yourself?
Sure. So, I'm Amy Lowe. I'm a writer and recently got back to Montreal, Jojage, after spending quarantine in BC at my mom's place. So that's sort of where I've been the last little while. So I'm happy to be back, but I also still feel quite calm from being by the Pacific Ocean for so long. And I just put out this book, so I'm really happy to be talking about it. And certainly, it's not the kind of launch that I pictured, but I'm just grateful for every opportunity to share about it. And other things about me, I work at the Walrus magazine right now, doing like disability and inclusion work there. And yeah, hoping to get a dog soon, you know?
Nice. So you recently published your poetry collection, Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete. Could you tell us a bit more about the collection?
Sure. So it's a short little chapbook put out by Frog Hollow Press, which is an independent, like, two-person publishing house in Victoria, BC. And I wrote the majority of the poems in 2017, actually. They're part of my master's thesis. And then I originally, like, submitted part of it as like an article to Hamilton Arts and Letters, which is a different like literary magazine. And then the editor of that special issue invited me to include more poetry in this chapbook that now exists out in the world, and it's called Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete. So yeah, it's been a really interesting process. Like, it's the first time I've worked with a publisher, and so I just learned a lot, and I'm super grateful to have it in my hands, because for a while, all my author copies were here in Montreal and I was in BC, so I hadn't actually held on to one until very recently. So it's quite cool. Nice experience.
So this book is part of a larger disability series by Frog Hollow Press. Could you describe some of the series and what it seeks to create?
They're doing a lot in terms of promoting disabled writers. There's a lot of industry barriers to publishing for a lot of different people with like experiences of marginalization, including disabled writers. And so they've kind of taken a stance of seeking out writers who are disabled or who write about disability. So some of the poetry it's not like directly speaking to disability or anything, but it's just like by writers who identify as disabled. And yeah, they're just doing a lot to promote like Criplit in Canada. So yeah, it's just like a great series. A lot of the books, they're quite short, they're snappy, and they're like really easy to get through. So it's kind of like a nice series in that way too.
So what was the process of writing this book like, and where did you draw inspiration from?
I got inspiration from wheeling around the seawall in Vancouver. So for people who don't know about it, it's sort of like this huge, long, multi-purpose path along the ocean in Vancouver. And the process was funny because I usually write little snippets on my phone in like Google Docs and then patch them together. Like when I was writing the things that ended up in the book, I didn't know that I would put them together in that order. But they just kind of, like, after I had these little nuggets, then I started weaving them together. And I decided that I wanted to, instead of having like each poem have a title at the top, I decided that I wanted to have more of a like flowing narrative between them, almost like a story that contained different poems rather than having like poem number one on page three and poem number two on page six. And I'm quite satisfied with it. I'm happy with how it turned out. And I'm always really curious and delighted to hear what other people think too, whether it's positive or negative. You know, I like one of the reasons that I decided to publish this collection was to start conversations. So mm-hmm. I'm very happy about that.
So one of my favorite excerpts from the book is on page 21, and it's, "My friend said no one teaches you how to be disabled. I figured out my way of learning how to be myself is through writing it." And to me, it means a lot because there's truly no guidebook on disability because of the vast number of experiences and the vast number of ways that disability exists. So I'm curious to know how you started this process of discovering yourself through writing and how it's impacted you.
I've always written when I was a kid. Like, my dad had a home office and he gave me like these little scraps of paper like after he cut up whatever documents he needed to shape to like a certain size, and then I would like staple them together and write little books for myself. And then got older, I studied a lot of like philosophy and political writings from like, I don't know, the 1900s, 1800s and stuff. And I found that it was like, in order to kind of digest what I was reading, I wrote as well. And then it kind of translated when I started having more like accessibility barriers and stuff. I started writing to also like help myself process, but also articulate what pissed me off about that and how I wanted things to change. And it's always been kind of a way of both like breaking down things around me to understand them, but also like writing what I desire and what I see as possible for myself and the people that I care about too.
So in Crip Ancestors, you include a quote by Sam Sullivan on the state of disability organizations. So it's, what's happened over the decade is, you know, we used to have strong advocacy groups full of angry disabled people who couldn't get on with their life because society was not dealing with their issues well enough. And when society did finally loosen up and deal with the issues, all disabled leaders left and went off and lived their lives and did what they wanted to do. Disability organizations, advocacy and service, very few are run by disabled people. In a way, it's a great tragedy. In a way, it's a great success. People with disabilities don't have to be advocates. It's all being done, or much of it has been done. And then the subsequent line, you say, "This feels different than the case in Quebec and my queer Crip communities. This feels like non-Crips being more hireable than Crips in the job of administering our lives." So I'm curious to know your perspective on this phenomenon.
Sam Sullivan is the former mayor of Vancouver, and he's a current MLA in BC in the Liberal Party there, which is quite conservative national standards. And he's an interesting character because he was the first visibly disabled mayor in the country, and he sort of came up through a communities of activism, I guess, and then became a politician. And not to say that he doesn't still like advocate and stuff, but yeah, sort of through this section of our conversation, yeah, he expressed like both sadness that, or not sadness, but he was like kind of lamenting what he saw as like a shift from, he said it, like angry disabled people sort of like leading the front line in like accessibility work. And then in his opinion, like a lot of organizations are run by non-disabled people, because he suggested that like disabled people have less barriers, so they're just like out doing whatever it is that they want to do. And it was really interesting for me, because it's true that I, you know, like probably in Vancouver, a certain portion of like the disabled demographic is out and doing what they want, because like a lot of things are more accessible, but also that's sort of like a middle class experience for sure. Because yeah, if you're working class or just like struggling with money, that ain't it, right? And so that was one side of it where I was kind of like, okay, wow, that's not an experience that related to me at the time. And then also there's a huge frustration I have with disability organizations that are led by non-disabled people. Like, I just don't think that that's a practical type of leadership, because if you have like lived experience of something, you just have a deeper knowledge of it. And so I personally think that like organizations should be run by the people that are sort of supposedly benefiting from them. And then also like just from like a work perspective, it's like if all these organizations are run by like administrators who don't have those experiences, like it's just like a lost work opportunity too for like a lot of disabled people who are just as qualified, right? If not more. So that's sort of how it came in. And it's interesting because like this poem, it's called Crip Ancestors. And I was kind of drawing on like something that Leroy Moore, who's Bay Area disability writer, activist, artist, you know, like has articulated a lot in terms of Crip Ancestors. He's got a book by that title as well. Or I think it's Disabled Ancestors. But so I was sort of like exploring what that meant for me through the poem. So I was like looking at who were the people who made the curb cuts that I now just like easily roll down, or who were the ancestors who thought up beeping buttons so that people who are blind can cross the street easily and stuff. And so I was just sort of like playing with that idea. But I was also like, I wanted to include multiple voices in the poem. So that's why I included sections of my conversation with Sam Sullivan as well, because he and I, we have like quite different opinions on some things, but I wanted us to be in the same poem, because like you mentioned, Zoe, like disability is such a vast like umbrella term. The more voices in the thing, the better. So that's why I decided to have like quotes and sections of conversations with people in the poem and throughout the book as well.
Sam Sullivan is one of these kind of recurring characters in the book, and you include another quote by him. Is there like other instances of other repeated conversations from different people in the book, and how is that impacting the greater narrative?
The like opening quote is by Lynn Gale, and she's an Anishinaabe writer whose book Claiming Anishinaabe really influenced my writing as well, because her style was just like really conversational, like her style of writing. And her book is all about like determining her own identity and belonging, I guess, in her community, which is very different than mine. But I just really resonated with her, and she was really gracious, and I had an awesome interview with her for the project as well. So she definitely plays in a lot to the book as well, not only in terms of like quotations, but also in the way that I was thinking about access and how like I move through different accessibility circles as a settler, and just how I move through Canada as a settler and have a lot of access. Even if I have like mobility barriers, I still have a lot of access just because of white privilege and settler privilege and stuff. And so yeah, she, you know, she's like one of my heroes, to be honest. She definitely played in. And also like the poem, which is called I Have Heard, I wrote it after I did this sound walk with my friend Helena Crowbath and one of her collaborators out in Vancouver too. And they did this really cool project where they walked through part of East Van and like encouraged people to close their eyes at certain parts and do like funny things, like walk past this little community garden, put out your hand and close your eyes. And Yeah, the project was called Meet Me in Listening. And so the idea was to like listen to the soundscape of where you live as a way to connect with it. And so that experience really influenced the piece, which is called I Have Heard For Sure.
And going back to the poem about Crip ancestry, how do you feel the concept of ancestry has impacted that particular poem, and how we can use our ancestors' knowledge, for example, to influence our way of dealing with certain experiences, especially in regards to a disability context?
I think that disability history and disability activism history is really important, because a lot of experiences that we might have could make us feel alone. And so I feel strongly that having other disabled friends, and then also that people came before us and were looking out for us basically, is a really healing notion. You know, often people in the 60s who were advocating for deinstitutionalization, for example, they might have known it's not going to happen in their generation, but they're okay, we don't want this to be the case for future Crips. And so that's really beautiful thing. I want to learn more too about our history. There's some awesome people, Laurence Perron has done a really awesome job of documenting disability history in Quebec specifically. And there's some other folks too, just throughout our sort of context in North America. But I think it's really important. And I think it's cool too, to know, even the way that old mobility aids looked, or other tools, it's just cool, from a style perspective too, to be wow, the dudes in the 70s were rocking that stuff, you know? So It's just fun, but also feels important to know about our history.
So leaning back into the idea, disabled people leading disability organizations, and how abled people sometimes co-opt that narrative, how do you feel that art made by disabled people, like poetry, is different when it is self-written versus when abled people co-opt a disability narrative, for example, writing a character with a disability?
I think often disabled characters are written pretty two-dimensionally, mm-hmm. because they often in fiction or stories or even journalism, they often serve to act as metaphors for suffering or for having a hard time or for being inspirational or what have you. They're often used as a literary technique rather than described and shown as real characters in and of themselves. And when disabled characters are written by disabled people, that just doesn't happen, in my opinion, because they're not writing for a disabled experience necessarily, they're writing a whole person. So I think it's super crucial, and I love reading disability literature. It's very pleasing to me, and it's very cool to learn about other experiences that I don't have, or to think about things in a new way. And I mean, that's the awesome thing about reading, is that can enter someone else's world, but it has to be an authentic world. Otherwise, you're just kind of voyeuristic, right?
How did you use your own personal experiences? Because some of the, a lot of the poems are based on personal experiences, in order to craft some of the poems in this book.
I was just being really honest with myself. I wrote them for myself to figure some things out. I was really grappling with how does colonialism play into accessibility? How does accessibility play into colonialism? And so I was just trying to learn and write through learning. And so for me, that's often just personal writing. So I also learned that through writing this and also doing the research that accompanied it, that in order to learn more about that topic, I had to learn more about my own history and my own ancestry in terms of being, first/second generation Canadian as well. And just learning about my own place in Canada and how my parents/grandparents got here and everything. So it was an interesting process, because I thought that I would do a lot more learning from history and interviews, and I certainly did learn a lot, but I also was like, okay, if I'm asking all these people to expose parts of their stories, I have to do that for myself too, especially going forward and wanting to continue working in like disability justice and disability journalism, right? Like I had to really grapple with those things. So that's why it's so personal. And I mean, it's funny because I like writing other things too, but it always kind of, when it comes to poetry, it's usually pretty personal and this is what I think and feel and there it is, you know? Mm-hmm. But that said, it's not like, it's not freestyle. I worked a lot on them and like shaped them in the way that I wanted. It wasn't just a one-shot deal and then there it is, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, but I feel good about it. I mean, it's funny, I remember like having a conversation with someone else who writes like first person essays and poems as well. And I remember her saying how sometimes readers will say, oh, like it's almost like a diary. And it's like, it is, but it isn't, because as a writer, you're extremely selective about what you're putting there and you're conscious of the repercussions of what you put in a book. So like, yeah, it's like a very product. It's like a final mm-hmm. product that you know is going to be out in the public, you know?
Mm-hmm. So the final poem of this book is Poetry is My Primary Partner, and it's a sort of love letter to the genre. So how has poetry, either the reading of it or the writing of it, impacted your life?
Well, it lets me like fuck with everything basically. So mm-hmm. that's why I like it so much, because I love writing essays too, and I like coherence in some ways, but what I love about poetry is that it can be disjointed. You cannot know what you're talking about. You can say, I don't know what this is, but let's like continue and see what happens. And it's always just been like my go-to writing. Like when I sit down to kind of work out my thoughts, that's what ends up coming out first. So that's why I said like it's my primary partner, because it's like my core to how I like think and work through the world basically. Yeah, that's basically it. And it kind of makes me think of like someone who read the manuscript earlier on before it was like finalized, told me that I was an unruly writer, and he said it jokingly and lovingly, I think, but I was also like, damn, that's like the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. I do want to not follow conventions sometimes, and I also want to encourage other people to not follow conventions just for the sake of it as well. And so I hope that with that poem and with the whole collection that I can model that to an extent, or encourage people to fuck with things in their own ways too.
So if readers wanted to get a copy of this book, how would they be able to do so?
So yeah, it's called Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete. And probably the easiest way, the link is on the Frog Hollow Press website. Or if people like find me on social media, at Amy is writing. So I'll spell out my first name. It's @AIMEE is writing. I've got it posted all over there. So Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as well. And yeah, you can just buy it directly off the website of the publisher. And I would love that. And I'm serious. Like I do want to hear what people think. So if anybody actually has read it or is planning to, please hit me up, because I'd love to know what you think or what it made you think about. For sure.
And do you have any upcoming projects that you're working on?
I do. I have a full manuscript in the works. And I have like a longer term fiction project that I'm working on, which is probably not going to see the light of day for like probably 2 years, because it's just like a really long project, but I'm enjoying it thoroughly. And I also have like a writing group that I recently started with Autonomy Press, which is like Montreal's go-to gay publisher, and collaborating with Keyberg McGill as well. So if people like want to stop by next writing club, it's going to be on September 3rd. And you can just look it up again through my social media, or else just look up Unruly Writers Club. And basically what we do, we meet for an hour and a half and do writing prompts or else just work on our own projects. And it's basically just to encourage each other as writers and just encourage us to tell stories that we would have wanted to read when we were little baby queers or baby crips or whatever. So yeah, people are more than welcome to join that. It's all online right now. It's all by Zoom.
Thank you, Amy.
Okay, this thanks, Chloe. I have heard Skytrain and Rebel cry, not angry, but catalytic, bees purposefully landing on ragged, small edges, while a human power washes or power vacs a machine or home. I have heard smells entering my nose as I breathe deep, and twigs are bent under me, the click-click of my joystick, engaging as I consider moving or staying still, mechanical and natural blending. Or is it rolling over, caressing, or masking a way in? Scraping, beeping, sound renders me visible, witnessed, without my express consent. A selection of observations and questions. And is there a way to be present without being witnessed? Steps and crunching of round and yellowed leaves. The attention of buzzing, hurried, furry bees. Not drawn to bent twigs or beeping or occasional humming of seat angle adjustment. To be present without being witnessed, to be present without being an object of attention, to invite witnessing by those I choose. Unspectacularly belonging. To be present, welcomed, and move alongside with negative, positive, ambiguous, uncertain space accounted for and filled with warmth. To want to be included, to desire unspectacular belonging. To be present without being witnessed, unspectacular belonging. These are the best blessings of bees and moss. We called it being in nature unmediated.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche at CKT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an interview with Amy Lowe about her recent book, Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete. If you would like to support this book, you can purchase it at Frog Hollow Press. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special presentation of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKT. Thank you, Zerdu, to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at AvalancheCKT or CKT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKT.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay. That's up next. We'll be right back.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Quelle belle musique pour commencer. Donc, vous écoutez Audio Smut sur CKUT au 90.3 FM. Et vous avez aujourd'hui Palina et Mycelium comme host. Aujourd'hui, on a un show spécial. La musique que vous entendez en arrière de moi, que vous entendez au début du show, est en live, en direct, dans le studio. On vous a préparé... un show un peu spécial, c'est expérimental, happening, musique en live, poésie et plus encore parce qu'on a besoin de heal. On n'avait pas de thème, on n'avait pas